Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Blog Talk family. You're listening to the Antique E Show and some music. Tonight, we have Mr. Seth Keller. The host of tonight's show is Miss Yvette Jordan. Are you on the line? Miss Yvette Jordan, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Leslie.
Great. Have fun tonight. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Hi, Yvette. This is Seth Keller.
Hi, Seth, and thank you for joining us. Welcome, everyone, for all of our listeners. I'm happy to have you with us as our guest this evening. For those of you who are not aware of Mr. Keller, he is a renowned expert in historic, coins and documents. Am I right, Mr. Keller?
Documents, actually. Manuscripts and rare books. I haven't been in the coin business for some time.
I see. Okay, well, would you share some of your experience with us?
Sure. We're specialists in really important American historic documents, so things like the Emancipation Proclamation signed by Abraham Lincoln and George Washington and Jefferson letters and Frederick Douglass documents, one of which I should plug, is being sold on eBay to benefit Haitian earthquake relief.
And suppose I was interested in making an acquisition and also a donation for relief efforts in Haiti. How would I go about that? I go on eBay and search for it?
Right. That item is listed on eBay, and it's selling. It's closing in 4 days. And if you just search for Frederick Douglass signed document, you should find me. Or under Giving Works to benefit the American Red Cross. But the item number is 13035932381. And actually, I chose that for a couple of reasons, but Frederick Douglass, besides being the greatest African-American abolitionist and the greatest orator and one of the great writers of his day, he did serve as minister to Haiti from 1889 to 1891. So I'm hoping that we get some good bids on this, and I'll end up donating a number of these documents.
Well, that's wonderful, and obviously it is much needed. I want to actually move back a bit and find out how you actually started your interest in this business and how you got started. Is it a family business, or did you start it on your own, or what exactly happened?
Yeah, a mix of that, actually. My parents were in the rare stamp and rare coin business, and I started working in that when I was about 8. But I always had a real deep interest in reading and learning about history, and about 22 years ago, decided to focus, rather than on coins and stamps, on the historic documents. And so I'm actually still in business with my parents and my sister, but 7 years ago I formed my own company, Seth Keller, Inc., and that's primarily what I do is building museum collections and dealing in buying and selling historic documents.
How do you find all of your acquisitions?
Any number of ways. I mean, some show up in obvious places, big auctions like Sotheby's or Christie's or Swan Galleries, which has a great African-American history sale once a year, coming up in February. And from other dealers, from collectors, and we've gotten some great things from museums that ended up owning either duplicates or items that weren't in the scope of their collection. And so, even though mostly what we do is buy for museums, we also occasionally buy from museums.
Okay, I see. I see we have a caller right now. Excuse me, caller, do you have a question or are you just listening? Hello, caller?
I'm just listening.
Okay, thank you, caller. I have another question. I am a history teacher, and I know a lot of times my family has several old documents, and I want to ask you, say, for someone who has several old documents in their family, how should they save them, or should they think about sharing them with anyone? Do you have any advice about that?
Sure. And number one, I love the idea of sharing. I take documents into my kids' schools, for instance, and show them on appropriate holidays. And I think items that have a local interest, a family interest, or a tie to anybody in school, I'd love to see them brought in. In terms of preservation, if it's important and you enjoy looking at it, then by all means have it framed, but just make sure you use ultraviolet filtering, plexiglass, and archival mats, which most framers can do now. But the best way to store things for the long term is out of the sunlight, out of light, and in archival folders or mylars, just things that would normally protect them. And the worst thing one can do is repair any tears with tape, by the way.
Okay.
That's
okay.
Old paper, particularly before the Civil War period, is likely to be what we'd now pay extra for, acid-free paper. Certainly,
is that right?
Yeah, if it's 200 years old, it didn't. There was no wood pulp paper. So those documents are really likely to last a long time.
Okay, well, that's curious, and the reason I say that is using personal experience I have, or my mother, rather, and our family has several letters from freed African-Americans, well, Africans at the time, in the early 1800s, and writing letters about how they moved up from Florida and North Carolina, and some of them are frayed and torn, and we have spoken about, oh, so maybe we should really save them, and how do we do that? So your advice is extremely helpful.
Yeah, if it's just, if it's strong enough and just has a couple of tears or frays, put it in Mylar or put it in an archival folder and don't handle it too much.
Okay.
And maybe scan it once so that if
family... Yeah, we've
family,
done that. Mm-hmm.
Good, great. And then if family members want to see it, you can often show copies, or if you ever have to make other copies, make them from the copies instead of from the original again. But if that kind of, if a repair needs to be made to protect it, then you've got to go to a real conservator. And if there are questions like that, probably the easiest thing is for somebody to email me, and I'll do my best to point you in the right direction.
Okay, and your email address for our listeners?
Seth@SethKaller.net, and I'll spell that. It's SETH@SETHKALLER.net. And the reason I don't just give the name of a conservator or two is that it really depends on the type of document that's being preserved and where it is, because we might be able to recommend somebody locally.
Okay. I want to ask you about your first major document. I know on your website I had seen you've done some work with the Emancipation Proclamation, 13th Amendment, and what was your first major document you worked with?
The really most important early one was a signed copy of the Emancipation Proclamation, and people are still shocked to see it when I get to exhibit them. You know, how could this be in private hands, and
yeah,
is this the one? And what happened is Lincoln was approached about providing us signed souvenirs that were sold for $10 apiece during the Civil War to benefit the troops. Sick and wounded soldiers were helped by the Sanitary Commission, and there were stores and places where souvenirs would be sold. And so 48 copies were produced and signed by Lincoln. And by now, we think roughly half survive, and most of those are in museums. And it was just mind-boggling because right after I got into this field, within about a year, I saw that and found that it was available and just, you know, couldn't believe that something that important would be available to collectors. And in my case also, not just collectors, but I found a number of people and brought them into this field to build collections that have then been donated to museums, or at least lent to museums. So I sold another copy of the Emancipation Proclamation in November of 2008, and that went directly to the Smithsonian on display.
Okay, but how did you actually acquire it? You bought it?
Yeah, the first one we bought at Sotheby's.
Okay.
And the same day I actually bought my second one privately. There have been six copies on the market in the last 40 years, and we've had the privilege of handling all six. So, and I think it's a mix between private acquisitions and auction acquisitions.
I see.
And let me just, you know, the signed copies of the proclamation are more than $1 million now, but there are original copies, not signed by Lincoln, but produced in 1863 in Harper's newspapers, for instance, mm-hmm. that are really accessible to collectors, about $250 for Harper's. Some newspapers from the period are a little less if they're not illustrated. Some are more if they're on the first day that something was published, for instance. But really important content documents can be had, even originals, at affordable prices.
Really? Well, if I'm thinking about something such as Antique Roadshow, something really commercial. Are you ever attending any of those, or if you meet ordinary people with any items, do you look at them or see anything about how authentic they are or not? You do appraisals, for example?
I can. I do appraisals, but for major museum collections.
Okay.
And authentication also. It's just hard to devote the time to that. So if there's something like a Lincoln document with great content or that kind of thing, then we can authenticate it. But otherwise, there's got to be some other ways. But the Antique Roadshow is a great example of, you asked earlier, how we found material. I've never been on it. I just can't devote the time to going to the roadshow for several days and looking at things. But I've benefited from the show a great deal. A couple of documents that were discovered on it sold after that. For instance, Thomas Jefferson's 15-page report on setting up Virginia's education system. And that was discovered when somebody walked into the Antique Roadshow with it.
Really?
And the appraiser put a reasonable value on it. But it sold at Christie's about a year or two after that, and we bought it. So I think I've had the luck of buying most of the really important documents that have been discovered and shown on the roadshow and sold since then. And a couple of them, I'm glad I wasn't the expert like that, because I would have put a much higher value on it than the price we eventually paid at Christie's.
Okay, so then I guess you got a bargain, huh?
Yeah, if somebody, this was, again, not for me, for a collection that's down at New York Historical Society, but if somebody had brought that to me and said, what's it worth, I would have said, probably at the time, $500,000, $700,000, something like that. And we ended up getting it for a lot less than that.
Okay. How did you meet Leslie Gist? Leslie Etheridge Gist.
Yes. I exhibit at the New York Antiquarian Book Fair every year. This year it's in March. And she came into my booth, I think last year, and we had a really nice conversation, and she told me about her collecting and writing, and I showed Leslie some of the things in our collection.
I see. And Charles Sumner, am I right? Was he also there?
Okay. Charles Sumner, we had a great printed pamphlet from his fight against slavery. Sumner was the U.S. senator who was attacked on the floor of the Senate because of his anti-slavery views.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so severely damaged that he injured, that he never recovered from it. But the incident helped Northerners become more anti-slavery, and it also provided Southerners with an outlet where they were supporting Preston Brooks, who was the attacker. So it really was one of those events before the Civil War that led to the crisis.
All righty. I want to move on a bit and talk about what you're doing with Phyllis Wheatley's poems.
Yes.
So I think there's an exhibit that is coming up.
Yes. First of all, Wheatley's poems, Phyllis Wheatley was the first African-American woman to publish a book, and at the time, in the 1770s, people refused to believe that she could be a writer, and so she had people like John Hancock actually write letters of recommendation, and she published her book in 1773 of poems, and just last week, we were asked by a gallery in New York to lend it for an exhibit, and so we did. And at Babcock Galleries, which is 724 Fifth Avenue, and it's starting on January 21st, running through April 2nd, it's called African Americans Seeing and Seen. So in art and creating art. And it should be an interesting exhibit. We ended up lending three things to it.
Okay, so that's African American Seeing and Seen at Babcock Galleries in Manhattan.
That's right.
Okie doke. I just want to say right now, listeners, I know you're there, and I want you to be patient. We will accept some calls in about another, say, 12 minutes. So hold on, and thank you for holding. The website for the exhibit is that, what is that, Mr. Keller?
You know, let me...
Babcock.com?
www.babcockgalleries.com. Okay. And also, I'll put a link, we haven't done it, but I'll do it tomorrow. I'll put a link on my website, www.sethkeller.net. Because then I can mention a couple of other exhibits we're involved in too. We have some of our great Lincoln material on display in another art gallery in New York, Quest Royal Galleries. And I also have to mention a really great exhibit at New York Historical Society. That doesn't have anything for sale like my art gallery exhibits, but it's just got amazing original art, artifacts, documents, and great interactive exhibit materials to computer screens and things where people of all ages can put themselves into the history a little bit.
Okay, and what exhibit is that at the New York Historical Society? And you have any idea how long it runs?
It runs through April. Let me get the last day. I forget, but I think it's around April 15th. And it is called Abraham Lincoln in New York.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And you know what? I should check that. It could be March 15th, but I don't have the dates right in front of me.
Okay.
I'll have that on my website, too.
All righty. Great.
Clarify that. Yeah.
No problem. I want to start accepting some callers. So, caller, are you there? Do we have any callers who have a question for Mr. Carl?
Yes, I would like to ask him a question.
Sure.
Yes, hi. I am the recipient of some family documents that have been in my family since the mid-1800s. My grandmother was very meticulous and made sure she kept these documents in tin boxes, and I think that's the only reason they've been preserved so well. Can you give me any idea as to what I might do to continue the preservation of them, because I certainly don't want them to deteriorate?
Sure. Are they folded now, or are they unfolded?
Most of them are folded. They are some of them are letters, others are deeds, other family documents, and most of them, unfortunately, are folded.
Mm-hmm. No, that's not a problem, actually. That can help preserve it as well. I would say a couple of things. If you can scan the letters or photograph them, that's actually a great way to preserve them for other family members to see and to share and to make sure there's a record of it besides the original. So that's one thing. The other is, in an art supply store, you can buy these archival materials, either Mylars that can, depending on the size of what you have, they can go in a loose leaf book or an archival box. And just keep them in a place where it's relatively stable in temperature and humidity. So attics and basements aren't great. Most people's houses are. And, you know, even if you listen to a museum curator talk about the ideal circumstances, you know, you'd never have light on anything and it would be very stable humidity and very stable temperature. But in the real world, most people can't create those conditions. And many, many documents survive just by being kept out of extremes.
I see. Well, I also have a book that I believe was presented to my great-great uncle. And it's signed by John Brown.
Ah, no, that's wonderful.
How do I preserve a book?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry, caller. I was going to say, is there first a way of seeing if it's authentic or not, if it's actually John Brown?
Right, that's a good question.
Well,
I guess I've been making an assumption that it is.
You know what? That I could look at and probably would be able to tell by a photo sent by email or by mail.
Fine.
I love John Brown, his writings, and I'd be really happy to look at that.
Oh, very good. I'll see that you get it.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so then you can go on the website and find how to reach him, and then you can forward all of that information. Okay, caller?
Very good. Thank you so much.
Sure.
All right. Thank you.
After I see it, I can also recommend how to preserve it. If it's a valuable book, and that would be one, then it might be worth either in an art supply store buying a box for it or something you know, fancier would be having one made by a bookbinder. But books signed by John Brown are very rare and would be wonderful to preserve.
Okay, yes, that's the way I feel about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Seth, for accepting her call. And your website again, please?
www.sethkaller.net. S-E-T-H-K-A-L-L-E-R.
All righty, thank you. Is there another caller? You're on the line with Seth Kaller. Okay, we'll wait for... Maybe others are shy at the moment.
Okay. You know, could I talk a little bit about Frederick Douglass then?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you. Oh, okay.
Great.
You go right ahead.
Sure. He's just one of the figures that fascinates me. And Fred Douglass was born in Maryland and escaped from slavery in 1838. And soon went on to write a great book, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass. And it was so popular that he actually had to escape the country. So he went to England and went on a speaking tour and continued to write and eventually was able to come back here and publish a newspaper, The North Star, and really made a difference in, some would say convincing, others would say helping Abraham Lincoln to allow African-American troops into the Civil War armies, the Union Army, and then give them combat roles. And then Douglass fought for the 13th Amendment and the Equal Protection Amendment and the Voting Rights Amendment and for women's rights. So he was just a really great American. And his connection to Haiti was serving as its ambassador, America's ambassador, in the 1880s. And so I've wanted to help in some way and wasn't in a position to give the kind of cash donation that I'd like to make and that I know that they need. So I figured what I'd do is donate some of the documents signed by Douglass and get some bids and give 100% of the proceeds to different charities that are supporting Haitian relief. So the first one is on eBay now to benefit the Red Cross, but I think I'll put others on to benefit the Clinton Bush Haitian Relief Fund, which is just getting started.
That's phenomenal, Seth, really. And how is it going? Is it moving at all on eBay or not?
Got its first bid. I put these are documents that I sell for $495 each, and I put it on with an opening bid of $200, which was bid today. So, and it's closing in 4 days, and most people tend to hang back and bid at the last minute, but this is really a charity thing, and so I'm hoping that people will bid sooner. And it is, you know, I do have more than one that I'm going to give, so the sooner it reaches the $495, there's a buy it now option, then I'll just put the next one up.
Okay, do you use eBay often as a vehicle for you selling if you want to move something quickly? Or
I don't. It's may even be a year since I've put something else up. We've sold some good things on eBay, but the problem there is you're competing against so many forgeries, basically, and so many things that aren't properly described that it's not a good venue for us to be selling things.
Okay, so your credibility, you're saying, may be in question if you do that over and over. Is that what you're implying?
Not so much. That I'm not worried about my credibility, but it just doesn't attract the kind of audience. In the first year or two where people started looking on eBay, a lot of collectors were very excited about it and went on, and good collectors found good things. But as it expanded, the quality sort of left it, and the good bidders left it too. So there are still some, and there are very sharp buyers and very sharp sellers, but by and large, the good collectors just don't have time or aren't willing to take the risk of buying on eBay, and so people like me have stopped putting things up there.
Okie doke. Where are your exhibits now? Are they at... you mentioned Babcock. Are there any other places you show your items?
Yeah,
your documents?
There's another gallery, Quest Royal Fine Art, in New York City. Hopefully, starting this summer, we'll have an exhibit in Nantucket. And I mostly, though, what I do is work out of my office in White Plains, New York, and have private showings when necessary. So I really love lending things to museums. When they call, I do my best to say yes. And when there are art galleries or others, that any place that has the right kind of facility and has really an opportunity for people to come and see these documents, I enjoy, cooperating with.
So even, are you aware of the Underground Railroad Museum in Philadelphia, and is that a type of a venue you would use, or say any local historical societies focusing on African American heritage, for example, especially around February? I'm thinking some may want to showcase what you have.
Well, the local historic societies tend not to have the right environment for originals. But if anybody like that, or teachers see something on my website that would be useful to them, at the least I can send a high-quality image, and I'm happy to have people copy them.
You said a teacher?
Yeah. Yeah, if there's anything that'll be useful to you, let me know, and I'll get you out a good image and a good description that you can reproduce and, show to your students.
Okay.
Where do you teach?
I teach in Newark, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a high school, I'm a history teacher. So, I'll email you.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
I'll actually have an exhibit right around George Washington's birthday at the Paramus Museum.
Okay, that's not far.
Yeah, I just found out about last month, but that area, there's a new national park at Great Falls. I didn't even know there was a huge waterfall in New Jersey there, but one of our really wonderful George Washington letters was written from Great Falls, and so they're borrowing that to talk about the museum that they want to create there.
Okay. I want to move back and, and talk about the Underground Railroad Museum I mentioned a few minutes ago in Philadelphia, and whether or not that is a venue you would consider. I don't know if you responded to that question.
I didn't. I know the Underground Railroad Museum in Cincinnati. I don't know the one in Philadelphia. There, I know the African American History Museum in Philadelphia also.
Right.
And sure, I do work with institutions like that.
Okay, wonderful. In case anyone is listening who may want to explore that.
Yeah, and I mean, on the high end, what I really enjoy doing is building museum collections. And there are a number of new museums and other kinds of institutions that have display space, but that don't have great collections yet.
Right.
And so that's my kind of thing. The Smithsonian is planning this museum that may open in 2015. I think that's optimistic, but they've got a huge fundraising effort, and they are making some acquisitions, but really they've got to get people excited about collecting for them.
The African American Museum you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, uh-huh.
There's also in Washington, D.C., the African American Civil War Soldiers Museum, and they have just gotten bigger space. It's a small museum right now. It's only 700 square feet of display space, and they just got a space that's four times that size that should be open this fall. When it does, I spoke to the director as soon as I found out about their expansion. We loaned an Emancipation Proclamation to their last opening, and I look forward to bringing another one down to D.C. For the next opening.
All righty. I see on your website you also have the a letter by George Washington. Is that correct?
Yes. I have the one that you're probably noticing is the contract that he wrote to train his slaves in carpentry at Mount Vernon. That's an interesting document. It's two pages, and he handwrote the whole thing, basically financial information and what he's requiring. One of the things he says is, quote, if any of the Negro carpenters belonging to the estate should be committed to his care and management, he will use his best endeavors to keep them to their work and instruct them in whatsoever he or they may be employed about. So, in other words, this James Donaldson, who he's hiring, is to make sure that they work hard. And Donaldson was fired about a year later because he was supposedly too friendly or too easy on the Mount Vernon slaves. So it's chilling to work on, to be holding a document like that. And on the one hand, to, you know, appreciate and love what George Washington accomplished for this country, and then to have the negative part of it as well.
Yeah. Well, I was going to raise that and ask if you ever share any of your documents, and then when you go out and share them, if you speak about them and if issues like this actually are spoken about.
I haven't had that experience yet. The closest is again, with Mr. Lincoln, when I'm talking about the Proclamation or the 13th Amendment, or I have a whole Abraham Lincoln catalog now, and you do get people who want to call in or who email and say, well, Lincoln supported slavery or didn't want to end slavery and only freed slaves because he had to, and the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free any slaves. You know, there are people who say those things, and some of them have a grain of truth to it, but the overall picture is that they're just way off base. So we get that. Like, the proclamation, for instance, technically was written only to free slaves in
the South,
in Confederate-held areas, so
right.
Technically in areas that the Union did not control. But that made it, that proclamation, made the war a war for freedom, and as the Union Army advanced, the slaves were freed, and anybody who questions Lincoln's motives should go back and just read his earlier writing. I mean, there are some things that he said that were unquestionably racist to today's mind, and even to some back then, but he would never have been in the position he was in as president and being able to affect history if he didn't follow the mores of his day. But from very early on, his interest was in ending slavery, and it really for him was a question of what he had the power to do and what the country, the Congress, had the power to do when he was in Congress, and what the president had the power to do when he was president.
I want to ask you, since you're talking about Emancipation Proclamation, whether or not you have any documents regarding Juneteenth.
I don't.
Okay.
The best thing would be the newspaper printings from Texas on the announcement of emancipation. I have other announcements. Juneteenth is really when the last slaves found out about the Emancipation Proclamation.
Exactly.
So I have not the last, but very early printings and announcements. And I have had one of the most interesting, and there is one on display at New York Historical Society. There were many, many thousands of a small printing. And by small, I mean under 2 inches, really, that were handed out in the field as the Union Army went by. They were given out to slaves and escaped slaves and other soldiers, and I've handled a couple of those. There were a great many printed, but now they're scarce because they were distributed in the field and people were not... there were collectors, but not like there are today.
Okay. I want to move back 90 years or so from that time and talk about your another document of yours, and that's the Declaration of Independence, certain printings you have of that document.
Yes.
How did you acquire those?
Depends on which one. And let me start by explaining. We have original copies of the Declaration of Independence, and what does that mean? Well, there is this one signed document that's in the National Archives. There's only one that was signed. But there were reproductions made, and the very first reproduction and the second reproduction are quite valuable. And we've handled a number of those. So at the Quest Royal Gallery, for instance, they have one of our second editions of the Declaration of Independence on display. But those that look like they're signed, and we get calls and emails all the time from people that think that they have an original signed declaration, mm-hmm. and what it is are either these early reproductions or much later copies of them, second, third, fourth, fifth generation copies. And some can be 100 years old, and if they're not the first or second printing, they're not valuable, unfortunately.
I see.
But the most valuable, and this is worth saying because people may not recognize it, the most valuable copies of the Declaration are ones without signatures, because in July of 1776, the original had not been signed yet. It wasn't signed until the next month. So if you've got a newspaper printing of the Declaration or a broadside printing, which is a single page with no other information on it, those are worth more than the later copies that look like they're signed.
I'm sorry, Mr. Keller. I've got to stop you right there. I see we're almost out of time. It seems like we were talking and the time really went by so very fast. So I apologize for stopping. However, I want you to say your website one more time for our listeners.
Sure. Thank you, Yvette. My website is www.sethkaller.net, and we have... only a portion of our inventory up there, but our Lincoln catalog and part of our George Washington catalog and part of our African American history catalog, and lots of interesting things. So Okay,
and is there a phone number in case anybody wanted to call?
Sure, 914-289-1776.
Okay, and again, you have an auction going on eBay, and you have Phyllis Wheatley's documents. Where is that again? Babcock Galleries, am I right?
Right, Wheatley's poems is at Babcock Galleries in New York, starting this Thursday, and running for a couple of months. So, and we'll put up on Monday, we'll put up a notice on all these exhibits.
All righty. Well, thank you so much again, Mr. Keller, and listeners, thank you for listening in. This is Yvette Jordan, and this is the Gist of Freedom Show. Have a great evening.
Thanks, Yvette. Bye-bye.
All righty. All righty. Bye now.